advertising, in entertainment, even in education. And yet, at the same time, we're rightly shocked at scandals and abuse, the things that are exposed by the Me Too movement and the like. But who asks whether and how this behaviour, such behaviour, has been fuelled by the sexual revolution of the 1960s? Well, think how important self-expression is in our society. Be yourself, follow your heart. And yet we strictly police what sorts of self you're allowed to express. If you step out of line, then trial by social media can be swift and brutal. Think of the great success of the LGBT movement. But now there's a growing conflict between LGB and T. Traditional feminists are deeply concerned that biological men who identify as women will undermine safe spaces, will undermine equality, will undermine even women's sport. And many people feel uneasy about our culture, and yet they have no basis on which to say some things are good and some things are bad. What strange times we live in. And those of us who are Christians can feel even more at a loss. Christians have gone from being odd but decent to being the bad guys, maybe even dangerous bigots who need to be silenced. And then think of the great progress of science and technology. So many things that we couldn't imagine a generation ago, which are commonplace today. And if today's world is so different from the world we grew up in, speaking for people of my age and up, if today's world is so different from the world that we grew up in, how much more different is today's world from the world of Bible times, from the ancient Near East or the Greek Roman Empire? Like, they didn't even have Nokia brick mobile phones back then. The world is changing, some people say, and we've got to adapt with the times to evolve or die out. And the many chapels that lie empty or have been repurposed seem to say the same thing. How can we expect answers or even help from an ancient book? In a world such as ours, it seems madness to start our service with a long Bible reading. And just as crazy now to turn to the scriptures in the talk. But before we close our Bibles, before we close our doors, I want you to use your imagination. Firstly, imagine you're clearing out an old house. And in the loft, buried under all this stuff, is a chest, a small box. And in the box is an old map. And on the map is an X. And next to the X it says, buried gold. Now you think, is this just a made up map? But then you look on the map and you start to see landmarks that you recognize. You see that there's the new river, really new there. And there's the old church at the end of Clissold Park, but not the new one on the other side. And you realize it's describing exactly the area that we live in, even though lots has changed. So what are you going to do? Treasure hunt. You wouldn't say, well, we live in a completely different world and this map has nothing to do with it, because some things stay the same. Or imagine it was an old map. Imagine it was a really old map, but it has things on it which would be impossible to guess. Imagine there's a big green oval on the map, and the words next to it are field where big crowds watch men chasing pig's bladder. And this was like hundreds of years before association football was even invented. And yet it seems to know about the Emirates. How can that be? Well, maybe that's fantastical. But here's another scene. Imagine you're starting to feel unwell, but the symptoms are really strange, really odd symptoms. And you go along to the doctors. And the doctor's this really old guy. And you look at him and you think, how are you still in practice? You think, how are you still alive? And there on his shelf, he's got all of these books of medicine from the Middle Ages. But then when you open your mouth to start to describe the problem, he holds up a finger and then he describes your symptoms down to the very last detail. And it seems so unlikely, yet I think you'd be interested to hear what treatment he suggests, because he's described exactly the situation you are in. He's proved to be reliable by his description. Well, over the next few months, I'm planning for us to look together at 2 Timothy. This is the second letter preserved for us in the Bible from the Apostle Paul to his younger colleague Timothy, probably written around AD 66, 67. But I don't want us to start at the beginning today. Instead, I just want us to read some verses from chapter 3, verses 1 to 5. But understand this, that in the last days there will come times of difficulty. For people will be lovers of self, lovers of money, proud, arrogant, abusive, disobedient to their parents, ungrateful, unholy, heartless, unappeasable, slanderous, without self-control, brutal, not loving good, treacherous, reckless, swollen with conceit, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God, having the appearance of godliness but denying its power. Avoid such people. Now, just taking that description as a whole, does it sound familiar? Does it sound like somewhere you've heard of, somewhere you can picture? Well, I think so. These are the days that we are living in. But before we look at the details, I want us to avoid a mistake which it's very easy to make. I want us to ask, what does Paul mean by the last days? What does Paul mean by the last days? You know, people often assume that he's talking about a time at the very end of the world, the very end of history, just before the world's end. And in a way he is, but not in the way we imagine. After all, Paul describes what people will be like in the last days, and then he tells Timothy to avoid such people. He clearly thinks that he and Timothy are in these last days. In fact, the Bible uses the last days to describe the whole of the time from when Jesus first came to when he is going to come again, to his second coming in glory. We see that clearly in another part in the Bible, in Hebrews chapter 1. Long ago, the writer says, at many times and in many ways, God spoke to our fathers by the prophets, but in these last days, he has spoken to us by his Son. So we are definitely living in the last days. But so was Paul all those years ago. The last days started when Jesus came. Jesus is the great climax of human history. And what Paul is saying is that in these days, in these last days in which we live, Paul's day, our day, everything in between, and however long we have left, in these last days, there will be periods of time that are especially difficult. Not always, not all the time, but on and off through history. Now, some periods in history will feel very different from this description. We might think of the time in Acts chapter 2 and verse 47, where the church had favour with all the people. Everyone thought the church was wonderful. But times like that will always be replaced, sooner or later, with 2 Timothy times. Times like Paul describes here. Paul wanted Timothy to understand this, and God wants us to understand it too. Such dark times are not a blip, they're not an anomaly, they're not something strange. These sort of times will come. Times that are difficult, difficult to survive, difficult to navigate, painful and perilous, hard to endure and hard to cope with. And it seems absolutely clear that we are living in such a time. So I want us to zoom in on the details and ask how each description is seen in our modern world, our 21st century time. What are people like in these difficult times? It's people that make the times difficult. What are people like? Here's our description. People will be lovers of self, lovers of money, proud, arrogant, abusive, disobedient to their parents, ungrateful, unholy, heartless, unappeasable, slanderous, without self-control, brutal, not loving good, treacherous, reckless, swollen with conceit, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. Let's just look very quickly through that description. We're going to go at speed. 10 things, 10 descriptions. Firstly, people are lovers of self. That's how it starts, isn't it? People will be lovers of self. That's the most basic thing. So does that fit our generation? Well, ours is the selfie generation. And not just our photos. Be yourself. Follow your hearts. Self-expression. And our mental health can be balanced precariously on whether we get enough likes on our social media posts. Because it's all about self. And then secondly, people are materialistic, which means lovers of money. People will be lovers of self, lovers of money and what money can buy. You know, gone are the days when an orange in the stocking will do for Christmas. We are the Black Friday generation. As I was studying for this message, I came across a quote, a striking quote. It went like this. In this universe, there is God, people, and things. We should worship God, love people, and use things. But if we start worshiping ourselves, we will ignore God, and we will start loving things and using people. It's the wrong way around. We should worship God, love people, and use things. But when we ignore God, we start loving things and using people. That's what Paul is describing. And love for money is followed by this whole list of traits in which people are devalued. The love of money is the formula for a miserable life. And yet that sums up many people today. People are lovers of self. People are materialistic. What comes next? Two words there, proud and arrogant. Because self-love means you will be full of yourself. Self-love breeds arrogance. And we have the same at the end, don't we? There in the blue, very vivid, swollen with conceit. If people are full of themselves, then they will be dismissive of others. And yet think of our society. We're so full of our achievements, so full of what we can do, what we've accomplished, so ready to play down the mess of society, the ruin and misery that mark our ways. An exaggerated self-opinion assumes that those with a different worldview, whether in society or elsewhere in the world or back in history, that they're inferior. Because we're so sure about ourselves, we love ourselves, we become proud and arrogant as a society, and so we assume that anyone who thinks different must be inferior. So we don't go to other places and we don't go back in history to learn, but we simply go to identify our agendas and pronounce our judgments. That's how history is often taught. That's the modern approach to history. That is the neo-colonialism that ties our aid budget to abortion or the LGBT agenda. Self-love means you are full of yourself, so sure that you are right. What comes next? Well, arrogance makes people abusive. Full of angry, hurtful words. That's what comes next. That's what follows on when someone loves themselves, when they're full of themselves. Well, the way that they talk to other people is perfectly described there, abusive. Think of the tone of online discourse or of political point scoring, or even public interactions out and about. It all bleeds out of self-love. And all of this destroys families. Maybe the next five descriptions are all pointing to the impact of self-love, the self-love generation on family life. Disobedient to their parents, ungrateful, unholy, heartless, unappeasable. Now, John Stott was an insightful 20th century Christian statesman. And he wrote this: in an ideal society, the relationship of children to their parents should be marked by obedience, gratitude, respect, affection, and reasonableness. Does that describe the interactions in families? Is that our day? I think Paul's list is nearer the mark. Rebellion against authority in general. Ingratitude, feeding into the sort of entitlement, what I deserve. Unappeasable, unwilling even to discuss, unwilling even to come to the table, to consider. Hence the growth of cancel culture. And then number six, all of this spills out into public life. A description there, slanderous, without self-control, brutal, not loving the good. Think of business dealings, politics. People are acting humanly, and yet all the time we're so sure we're the pinnacle of civilization. It's a brutal description, isn't it? And yet, time and again, it's hitting the spot. Not loving the good. You might think of scandal and violence in entertainment. Anything wholesome is seen as tame, as bland. So what have we seen so far? What are the people like that make these times difficult? Lovers of self, lovers of money, full of themselves, full of angry, hurtful words. All of this undermines families, spills out into public life. And for a seventh characteristic, we could pick out that word, treacherous. Self-love makes people unfaithful. For example, in relationships. If it's stopped working for me, then I'll find someone else, irrespective of my wedding day promises. Because people love themselves. That's where treachery comes in. I'm just being true to myself, people say. Rather than being true to my word, or true to my promises, or true to my commitments, or true to my spouse. I'm just being true to myself. It's all about self. All springs from the same root. And then number eight, pleasure is now the great and only goal. See how the list is coming full circle. We started with lovers of self, lovers of money, and now it's lovers of pleasure. And all this is helped along by the basic confusion in our society between your identity as a human being and your sexual experience and preferences. That fundamental underlying confusion as to what it means to be you feeds into this. Lovers of pleasure. And yet we're not happy. Whatever people may claim, we look at this list and we say, is this list a recipe for contentment? Is it a recipe for contentment? The ability to make other people miserable is a poor substitute for true happiness. Such a society leaves a trail of broken people in its wake. And then number nine, it all comes with a deep dislike of the God of the Bible. Lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. You can see that in a way, this description of Paul's is a chiasm, like we saw with the whole big story of the flood. Both ends, we've got lovers, lovers of self, lovers of money, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. We come in a bit, we've got pride and arrogance, all swollen with conceit. Then we have this behavior, abusive, treacherous, reckless, and then in the middle, this whole list of things that damage families, damage society. And looking at the outside, looking where Paul starts and finishes, we see that The problem, the deepest problem, is that people's loves are misdirected. Rather than love the one thing in the universe which is more worthy of admiration and love than anything else, namely God, rather than love him, people love self and money and pleasure. And these are times of difficulty. That's how Paul described it, times of difficulty. It's difficult to be a Christian in such a world because society is not willing to live and let live. Our society is not willing to say, well, you Christians, you believe something different, but that's okay, we can all coexist together. It's not willing for that. Because they're lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. It's one or the other. Well, imagine we were to follow God's great commands for life. Imagine we were to love him with all of our heart, soul, and mind and strength, and truly and practically to love our neighbours. Would the world really be such a terrible place? But if we love ourselves, we'll have no room to love either God or our neighbours. So there's an inner logic in Paul's description. If you start with lovers of self, lovers of pleasure, these other things feed out of that. It's not sort of arbitrary. This is the shape. If you start with those points, that's where you'll end up. If you start in that direction, that's where you'll arrive. That's why the list ends where it does. And then one final connection with our society, and this might strike some people as surprising, but people like this may still be religious. See how the description ends? Having the appearance of godliness, but denying its power. Now, I don't think Paul is saying that unreligious people aren't like this. I mean, Paul is describing society in general, but I think he has his eye particularly on certain people where Timothy was, people who were religious, and yet who were all these other things too. People like this may still be religious. Now, I said that might be surprising, but it shouldn't be. Not if we're familiar with either the Old Testament or Jesus' critique of the religious leaders of his own day, or the history of certain popes and church leaders in the Middle Ages, or even abuse scandals in Christianity today. We shouldn't be surprised. People like this may still be religious, and I think that can happen in two ways. On the one hand, these attitudes infiltrate churches. People who have the title Christian, the name Christian, they can actually live like everyone around them, like society around them. Says, watch out for that, avoid that. You can't associate, you can't say, yes, this is a brother, this is a sister, they're just like me. But you know, there's something else. Those things in the list can coexist with religious type elements. For example, spirituality or superstition. You know, increasingly, our secular society has a very religious feel in the most unpleasant description of religion. The moral certainties of our society. It's witch hunts. It's assuming that it's taking the high ground. It's self-righteousness. Look at the self-righteousness of our society. I can't believe this was happening in number 10. Do I really believe that everyone who expresses outrage kept all of the rules perfectly? Society is rife with, you know, it used to be that the church used to have the corner on hypocrites. You know, people used to say, why is the church full of hypocrites? Our society is desperate to catch up. And so there can be this appearance of godliness in a sense of religiousness and yet denying its power. It doesn't change the heart. And so this here in 2 Timothy chapter 3 is the map that we've stumbled across, which so perfectly describes the times that we live in. This is the spot-on diagnosis from a source that most people would just dismiss out of hand. And the great single take-home, you can say, if you go home and you say, how many points did Phil have? He had 10. And he's got three more to close. But there's just one point from this morning. The great take-home is that this first century book knows all about our 21st century world. And that's why we're studying it. So one final question this morning as we close. Is there any encouragement that we can take away? It's been quite dark this morning, hasn't it? In our description of the world around us, it's been quite dark. Is there any encouragement we can take away? We've asked what Paul means by the last days. He's talking about all of history from the time of Jesus onwards. We've asked what people are like in these difficult times, and we've seen his description. Is there any encouragement we can take away? That's where I want to end this morning, because all of it can sound most discouraging, and in some ways it is. These things are ugly things, but I want to close with three great and related encouragements. In a sense, it's all the same encouragement, but I've put it as three statements, three sentences. Number one, God has not been taken by surprise. God has not been taken by surprise. What is the phrase which has happened the most, apart from the one rule for them and other for us, which you know which party that's coming out of. The great phrase of our times is, we live in unprecedented days. I heard that over the last 2 years. These are unprecedented times. There's an unprecedented use of the word unprecedented. And yet the thing is, are these unprecedented times? Well, yes and no. But God has not been taken by surprise. The times in which we live culturally have not taken God by surprise. He's not scrabbling about to wonder how to respond and react to these things. He knew all about it. And so secondly, and following on, we don't need a new message. We don't need a new Bible. We don't need a new revelation. You know, it will be easy to think the world we live in today is so different from Bible times. How could this book ever help us? So different. What we need is something new. We need new prophecy. We need new revelation. We need a new insight. The Bible's not going to be enough to get us through. And we see that God knows exactly about the times that we live in. We don't need a new message, a new Bible, a new revelation. That's a great encouragement to us. We've got everything we need. We don't need to go looking somewhere else. And then thirdly and finally and specifically, we have here in this letter of 2 Timothy instruction and help, which is perfectly tailored for the time we live in. Now, all of the Bible, we believe as a church, all Scripture is God-breathed and is useful. But some parts of it need more translation to apply to our own day. All of it is breathed out by God, all of it's inspired, all of it's useful, but some bits of it you read and you think, oh, I need to work really hard to see how that applies, how that connects, because things have changed in other ways in terms of where we are in God's plan. But 2 Timothy doesn't need translating. 2 Timothy doesn't need anything like that. This letter to Timothy is written into a situation exactly like ours in so many ways. And so we can look forward with anticipation to what God is going to teach us from it in the weeks ahead. Amen. Let's close with a song. It's a song we had last week. I didn't realize it was a song we had last week, and then I thought, this is the song we need to sing. And then I saw we'd sung it last week, and I thought, we'll sing it again. O church, arise and put your armor on. Hear the call of Christ, our